Thank you very much. It's very daunting to come on stage after Tariq Ramadan, but I'll try to do what I can. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his On the Social Contract, on the very last pages of his work, he wrote, and I quote directly, "Those who distinguish between civil and theological intolerance are mistaken, in my opinion. Those two types of intolerance are inseparable. It is impossible to live in peace with those one believes to be damned. To love them would be to hate the God who punishes them. It is absolutely necessary to either reclaim them or torment them. Whenever theological intolerance is allowed, it is impossible for it not to have some civil effect." End quote. Now, one thing that these quotes prove is that the issue of salvation is not merely a theoretical one. Rather, it goes to the very core of a person's values, of how he will define and treat the other. Therefore, this topic, this issue, has philosophical, theological, civil, moral, and political ramifications. However, we can't discuss all of them in any one lecture, and I'm coming to the podium primarily as a theologian or a theologian in training. So I will have to approach this issue purely from the theological dimension. My talk will be divided into two sections, followed by a conclusion. In the first section, I will point out the positions of the main theological movements of our religion, Islam, regarding salvation, and the primary Quranic evidences that they use to justify that position. In the second section, I will examine specific evidences that some modern reformists have used to argue against the classical understanding of salvific inclusivity for salvific exclusivity. In my conclusion, I will offer some personal comments on the issue. So part one, the overview of the theological positions of Islam on salvific inclusivity versus exclusivity. It shall come as no great surprise to anybody familiar with the Islamic tradition that every single systematic theology that was developed in classical and medieval Islam viewed the religion of Islam as being the sole path to God. And it's not just Muslims, we're talking at a time when pretty much every religion viewed itself in a similar manner. In fact, far from allowing salvation outside of the religion, the discussion was between the sects and whether other sects would be saved or not. By and large, the Mu'tazilites made takfir of the Asharites made takfir of the Hanbalites, all of them made takfir of the Falasifa and the Batinites, so on and so forth. But intra-Muslim polemics does not concern us here. The fact of the matter is that religious communities not belonging to Islam, the true other in our vernacular, were assumed to be outside the grace of God and in need of God's guidance. As far as I have read and researched, and I have read plenty of works of theology of all of these movements that we're going to talk about, the possibility of finding salvation in another religion while consciously and knowingly rejecting Islam was simply never even seriously entertained by any theologian or any scholar of any of the established schools of theology in the pre-modern era. The main theological issue that concerned classical and medieval theologians was not the salvific potential of other faiths, the absence of which was simply taken as a given, but rather the fate of those who had never heard of Islam or were exposed to falsified teachings. With regards to those who had never heard of Islam, the common term being tabligh al-risala, did they get the tabligh al-risala or not? The rationalist inclined Mu'tazilites, along with the Maturidites, they generally gave quite a lot of weight to the human intellect. Hence, they believed that a person would be legally responsible, mukallaf, to reject idolatry and affirm a monotheistic vision of God, even if no revelation exists. Failure to do so warranted eternal punishment and damnation, because the mind, the rational mind, according to the Mu'tazilites, could potentially lead to monotheism. The Asharites, on the other hand, typically reactionaries against the Mu'tazilites and all of their doctrines, they claimed that anybody who had not heard of the message of Islam would be forgiven, even if they were pagans and idolaters. This was based on their theological premise that the human mind, independent of revelation, cannot judge good and evil. The tripartite categorization of Abu Hamid al-Ghazali best illustrates this point. He categorizes mankind into basically three categories. Number one, people who have never heard of the message of Islam and who live in faraway lands, such as the Romans. These will be forgiven unconditionally. Number two, people who have been exposed to a distorted understanding of Islam and they have no recourse to authentic information. These two will be forgiven. The third category are those who have heard Islam because they live in the neighboring cities and the neighboring communities around Darul Islam. And they know the reality of Islam and they have access to authentic Islamic knowledge. These, according to Al-Ghazali, have no hope of salvation. The Hanbalite position manifested in the writings of Ibn Taymiyyah was that the intellect could discern right from wrong. And thus a sane, rational mind should logically come to the conclusion that there is an all-perfect God. Monotheism is logical. However, Ibn Taymiyyah argued, in God's infinite mercy and justice, God's punishment would not be meted out to any who had not been exposed to a messenger. In other words, even if logically you come to the conclusion that there is a God, until God tells you so, He's not going to punish you if you don't. Ibn Taymiyyah based this on many verses in the Quran, such as 17:15, we are not going to punish until we send a messenger. So according to Ibn Taymiyyah, those who didn't receive a message or received a distorted version of the message, they're neither automatically forgiven nor automatically punished. Rather, they shall be tested on Judgment Day with a special test. In any case, from this spectrum, what we see is that the main issue is whether God might possibly forgive any who have not been exposed to the teachings of Islam. The underlying assumption for all of these traditions is that Islam is the only path to God, and anyone who consciously, volitionally chooses Islam, chooses other than Islam, will simply not have it accepted on the Day of Judgment. Moving to the books of fiqh, in each and every one of the four established schools of Sunni law, in their chapters pertaining to apostasy, pretty much the number one example that all four Sunni schools of law mention in their books of fiqh is that if a Muslim claims that he is of another faith, or a Muslim claims that a person of another religion is morally in the acceptable region, it is permissible to be a Christian or a Jew, this would in fact count as grounds for apostasy. In other words, belief in the validity of a religious system was seen quite sincerely and casually as a rejection of Islam. And this is unanimous across the four Sunni schools, and I'm not an expert in the Shia school of law, but I'm pretty sure they would also say something similar. The question arises as to why there was so much unanimity with regards to this principle. I honestly think it is unfair, and honestly it's actually not very academic, to dismiss this overwhelmingly predominant position because of, let's say, calling it a literalist tendency. The Mu'tazilites are not literalists. Or to accuse all of these theologians of having a fear of the other, or of having selfish motives of wanting God's mercy on themselves and not wanting it on others. I honestly believe that those theologians and scholars were better individuals than we are, and their motives were more pure than our own. They were brave enough to discuss many controversies, including God and the nature of God. And yet, amazingly, this issue of the salvific potential of other religions was unanimously agreed upon by all of them. And the reason for this appears to be that there were numerous clear and explicit Quranic evidences. So clear, in fact, that despite the fact that these groups couldn't agree about the nature of God, they could agree that the only path to God was this religion of Islam. Islam with a capital I, as we're going to come to. The number of evidences that are quoted in works of theology, and especially in books of tafsir, the number of evidences are so numerous that honestly many doctoral dissertations could be written on specific individuals. And what I've done for the sake of brevity is to categorize these evidences under categories. Numbers of verses under each category, and I'll emphasize the category with some examples of the verses. And in fact, for every category I mentioned, I'll mention only four, there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of verses that support these categories. The first category, verses that suggest the religion of Islam is the only acceptable religion to God. We've heard such verses for the last day and a half. And of these verses, Professor Ramadan quoted them, and other speakers as well. The only religion in the eyes of God is Islam. Whoever seeks a religion other than Islam, it shall not be accepted of him, and in the hereafter he shall be of those who are lost. Many times we neglect two factors about these verses. Number one, the context. Number two, the word itself. The context. The context of these verses, both of them occur in chapter 3. And they discuss, chapter 3, Ali Imran, it discusses Jews and Christians. It criticizes them for their deviations and praises them for the good. In the context of a Ahli Kitab discussion, when God is saying, I am only going to accept Islam. In fact, in one of the verses, right after this, God says in chapter 3, verse 85, God says, Inna deena indallahi al-Islam. The religion in the eyes of God is Islam, and the only reason that the people of the book differed was because of jealousy. In other words, right after saying the only religion is Islam, God criticizes Ahli Kitab. Similarly, in the verse before this, God mentions some of the deviations of the Jews and Christians. So after criticizing Jews and Christians, then God says, the only religion in the eyes of God is Islam. These verses have to be looked at the context of where they occur. Additionally, the word itself is a proper noun. The connotation that al-Islam here refers to some type of verbal submission to God actually goes against, in my humble opinion, and also in the opinion of pretty much all of the commentators of the Quran, it goes against the word form. God is not saying that the religion in the eyes of God is submission, Islaman. He is saying al-Islam, which is al-Islam, which is the Islam. And that only occurs in a proper noun. You cannot have alif lam before a verb. Alif lam means it's a noun. So what is being talked about is a specific, what has been called a reified understanding of Islam. Additionally, there are many other verses which don't have it as explicit, but still have a very clear-cut message that people have to believe in the message as it exists. In chapter 2, verse 137, once again, the verse is directed to Jews and Christians, and then it says, so if they believe as you have believed, then they shall be guided. But if they turn away, they are left in confusion. So it's quite clear that the context of the verses has to be taken into account. You cannot cut and paste phrases of the Quran and ignore where these phrases occur. The second category, the first was that Islam is the only acceptable religion. There are many verses there. The second category of verses, verses that suggest a rejection of the prophethood of Muhammad is tantamount to a rejection of God. The concept of prophecy is linked to belief and submission to God. One of the central tenets of the Quran is that belief in all the prophets of God is a fundamental precondition, or at least co-condition, with believing in God. In more than one verse, Muslims are told, we don't make any distinction between the prophets. In over 50 verses, various peoples throughout history have been criticized because of rejecting the prophets. كَذَّبَ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ الْمُرْسَلِينَ The people of Nuh rejected the prophet. The people of so-and-so rejected the prophet. In over 4 verses, God's punishment is linked to rejecting the prophet. كَذَّبُوا رُسُلِي فَكَيْفَ كَانَ وَعِيدٍ They rejected my prophet. See how my punishment was. So in a number of verses, belief in prophethood is a key condition to accepting God and believing in Him. In yet another verse, directed to the people of the book in the context of our Prophet Muhammad, in chapter 3, verse 81, there is a reference to a covenant that God took with all of the prophets, that you would believe in any prophet that comes after. لَتُؤْمِنُنَّ بِهِ وَلَتَنْصُرُنَّ So the context here is given, you must believe in every future prophet as that prophet comes. In the fourth chapter of the Quran, once again, within the context of Ahli Kitab, there is a verse that, in my opinion, is one of the most crystal clear verses, and it's not just my position, it is actually, I have read over 30 tafsirs specifically regards to these verses, and by and large, the message is the same. Chapter 4, verse 150, God talks about the people of the book, and then He says, those who wish to disbelieve in God and His prophets, by trying to separate between God and His prophets, and by saying, we will believe in some prophets and reject other prophets. Now this is not a verse that applies to Hindus or Buddhists or atheists. We believe in some prophets and reject in other prophets. The Quran quite clearly says, أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ حَقَّ These are the people who have really denied. They are the real deniers. Once again, in chapter 7, verse 156 to 158, within the context of discussing a very famous Jewish story of them meeting God and the 70 chosen people. And those chosen people pray to God and they say, "Oh God, forgive us for our sins." Right after that, God says, "My mercy encompasses everything." A lot of our speakers have quoted this phrase. They kind of sort of forget the very next phrase. "Therefore I shall write it." فَسَأَكْتُبُهَا. My mercy encompasses everything, but I shall write it to those who believe and who give charity and believe in our signs, those who follow the unlettered prophet, whom they find mentioned in the Torah and the Injil and their scriptures. Whoever believes in him and supports him and aids him, they are the ones who are successful. Once again, very clear-cut verse directed to the Ahli Kitab that they must believe in the chosen prophet. And we can go on and on. Of them is chapter 4, verse 115. Whoever opposes the messenger after the guidance has been made clear to them and follows a path other than the path of the believers, we shall lead him to that which he has chosen and take him to the fire of hell. And there are many, many other verses as well. The point being, the centrality of believing in the Prophet of God is a necessary pre or co-condition along with believing in God. The third category of verses, verses that suggest that a rejection of the Quran is a rejection of God. And again, I don't want to go into so many hundreds of verses. There are literally hundreds of verses that you must believe in this Quran as a revelation from God. The very first chapter on the second page, in verse 24, God challenges those who deny that this is a book from him. And he says, whoever doesn't believe this is a book from me, produce another chapter or another Quran like it. And if you don't do so, then your punishment will be the fire of hell. Once again, these are verses that are quite clear, quite explicit, quite numerous. Belief in the books is a precondition or a co-condition to ultimate faith in God. The fourth category of verses are verses that criticize the beliefs of other faiths. And we've mentioned quite a few of them in the last day and a half. Numerous verses in the Quran criticize the belief of the idolaters, of Christians, and of Jews. These are the three primary religious groups that the Quran came into contact with. The criticism of Arab paganism is a central thesis to most Meccan revelations. The pagans are castigated not only for their social practices, but also for heterodox and superstitious beliefs. It is not just orthodoxy, but orthopraxy that the Quran wishes for its people. The pagans are viewed as having strayed from monotheism and as having fallen into unjust social practices. As for the Ahli Kitab, the view is quite clearly expressed that the Ahli Kitab were legitimate for their time frames. They were rightly guided people, unlike the pagans. They had a book, they had a prophet, but over time they deviated, and both the Jews and Christians concealed or deviated from the true teachings of their prophet, hence the need to reveal a final message through a universal prophet. The criticism of key Christian doctrines is quite pronounced. Many times these doctrines are described by the verb kafara or the noun kufr, which is of course the antithesis of iman. The Trinity is described as kufr. Belief in Jesus as the Son of God is described as kufr. Worshipping Jesus Christ is described as shirk. And therefore, it is no surprise that the Ahli Kitab are referenced in the Quran as being those who kafaru. The term kuffar or kafaru is used for Ahli Kitab in over 5 or 6 verses. Of them is 2205. وَدَّ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ وَالْمُشْرِكِينَ. The people who have done kufr, both of the Ahli Kitab and the pagans, do not wish for any good to come to you. Of them is Surah Nisa, verse 489. وَدُّوا لَوْ تَكْفُرُونَ كَمَا كَفَرُوا. They wish that you become kafaru like they have become kafaru. So the term kufr and kuffar and kafaru is used for the pagans, and it is also used for the Ahli Kitab. Simply because God calls them Ahli Kitab doesn't mean that they are rightly guided. It simply means they are the best of those who have disbelieved. They have much in common, unlike the pagans who have less in common. And this has been the standard dominant position of Sunnis and Shiites and Mu'tazilites and other theological positions, that the Ahli Kitab are a category of kuffar and not distinct from the kuffar. And the Ahli Kitab have certain legal privileges that the non-Ahli Kitab do not have. Therefore, any interpretation of any phrases or any verses that argues for the theological acceptance of other religions must take into account the hundreds of verses that mention key critical tenets of the religion. And Before we move on, I'd like to mention, of course, that I have completely sidelined the hadith literature because it is not possible to formulate a pluralistic interpretation of Islam except by rejecting and neglecting the hadith tradition. If you're going to accept the hadith tradition, then really it's a moot point anyway. In addition to the Quran, hadith we've ignored, there's also ijma. A number of Sunni theologians have unanimously mentioned, including Al-Ghazali, and even in our times, Al-Qardawi and others have unanimously mentioned that those who follow another religion, consciously rejecting Islam, knowing Islam and rejecting it, that's the key, of course, we're going to come back to this. Knowing Islam and rejecting it cannot be considered to be guided. In addition to this, there's also illogical evidence that a number of theologians, including An-Nasafi, have used, and it is a simple logical premise, and I think the same exists in Christianity, and that is that a claim that more than one religion is simultaneously valid is simply illogical, because each religion has tenets that would be deemed blasphemous by the other. They can't be all right at once, would be the simplest way of phrasing it. So if all of these groups have claimed Islam's salvific exclusivity, has anyone ever disagreed in the history of our religion? It turns out that there have been a handful of dissenting voices. These comprise primarily of two groups, one in medieval Islam and one in our own era. The first group of medieval Islam comprised of certain elements within the Sufi faction, and the second group in our time are modern reformers. The first group is best exemplified by people like Ayn al-Qudat al-Hamadani, Ibn Farid, Ibn al-Arabi, Ibn Sab'in, Jalal ad-Din al-Rumi, and others of their nature. Their writings do have elements that can be considered to be supportive of pluralistic doctrines. For these Sufis, anyone who had a genuine love of the divine was on the correct path regardless of a specific religion. It is crucial to point out, however, with regards to such Sufi figures, two points. Firstly, as far as I can tell, none of these Sufi figures cared to back this claim up with any Quranic evidences or prophetic tradition. That the truth was found beyond the Quran simply trumped the very usage of the Quran. They felt no need to quote any scripture. Verses that modern reformers that are calling to a type of soteriological pluralism, quote, are markedly absent from the discussion of those medieval Sufis. Secondly, the belief in the validity of other religions by these Sufis was not due to any inherent doctrine that truth itself was more than one, but rather was based on the doctrine that there was no existence of anything other than the truth. In other words, a belief in the validity of all religions was a natural result of the belief in monism or wahdat al-wujud. For if there was no existence other than the existence of God, this implies that anything anyone worshipped would in fact be God. And there are a number of explicit quotes from Ibn Farid, Ibn Arabi, Ar-Rumi and others that clearly link belief in wahdat al-wujud to a case of salvific pluralism. The second group that has argued for this are modern champions of reform. They claim that salvific plurality stems from a true reading of the Quran itself. Some of them, such as Reza Shah Kazimi in his work, The Other in Light of the One, has explicitly championed the model of Ibn Arabi. And so he simply comes under the message of Ibn Arabi. Others, such as the traditionalist or perennialist school, have expanded these notions and infused them with other thoughts, in particular those of Fritz-Dorf Schwann and others of the perennialist school. However, there is a category within this reformist camp that stands outside of the Sufi message, and at least do not openly reference it. Perhaps the most famous amongst them would be Fazl al-Rahman, and in our times, Abdul Aziz Sashadina, and our own esteemed Farid Ishaq. This last group in particular is extremely significant because it is the first and only group, to the best of my knowledge, to explicitly argue for a message of pluralism stemming directly from a reading of the Quran. In other words, in contrast to medieval Sufis, the four or five who said this, who viewed, and they viewed themselves of course as Ahl al-Haqiqah, so they don't have to care about the Ahl al-Zahir and the evidences that the Ahl al-Zahir have to occupy themselves with, this last group actually felt that the Quranic message is one of pluralism. And of course it is this group that I will devote some attention to. The primary evidences that this group uses are two. The first is this concept of Islam with a small I. or a religion of Ibrahim, or a sense of submission. And they quote quite a number of verses, which are very valid and true, that God wants us to submit to Him. And that what is important is not being a Christian or a Jew, but rather being upon the religion of Abraham, Millata Ibrahima Hanifa. Now, the problem that I see with this understanding is that the Quran itself defines that submission to the will of God. And it includes a submission to key tenets that God states we must believe in. In particular, belief in monotheism, belief in the prophets, the books, the angels, and the day of judgment. In numerous verses in the Quran, iman or faith has been defined as believing in these particular doctrines. In many other verses, a rejection of these particular doctrines has been called kufr. Therefore, to cut and paste verses in isolation of other verses simply not very academic. To suggest that the three monotheistic faiths are all subsumed by a larger faith called Islam with a small I, and that this is the Islam that the Prophet came to preach, is basically to view a handful of verses in isolation from literally hundreds of other verses that show the contrary. It also ignores specific criticisms that the Quran has to existing Jewish theology and Christian theology. And many of those criticisms are found in the context of the verses that mention Milla Ibrahim or mention the concept of Aslama or Yuslimu. And I have some here, but we don't have time to get into them. The Quran clearly outlines what this Milla Ibrahimiyya or what this Islam with the small I was. And the Quran clearly criticizes those who seek to differentiate between the doctrines of God, the prophets of God. In fact, in even one verse, God criticizes those for rejecting one angel as having committed kufr. The angel Gabriel in Surah Baqarah. One angel, if you disbelieve in him, God says this is a type of disbelief. So to simply pick some vague verses and examine them while ignoring the hundreds of other verses on the topic is not a very, if you like, academic discourse. Quite a number of verses mention the criticism that is due to the Christians and Jews for having rejected the prophethood of the Prophet Muhammad. Of them is 447. O people of the book, believe in what has been revealed to you, meaning the Prophet, for it is an unzila ilayk is the Prophet here, for it is an affirmation of that which is with you, meaning the Jews and the Christians. Believe this before the punishment comes and we disfigure faces and turn them around and curse those who were cursed, or we curse them as we curse those who broke the Sabbath. This is chapter 4, verse 47. Similarly, chapter 4, verse 115, again in the context of Ahl Kitab, whoever opposes the messenger after the guidance has been made clear to him and follows another way, we shall leave him to that way and take him to the fire of hell. Another primary evidence that people in this reformist camp use is the famous verse 262. Those who believe, the Jews, the Christians, the Sabians, whoever believes in God and the last day, and you all know the verse, we have heard it at least 25 times in the last day and a half. This particular verse, Fazlur Rahman, this is the key point that Fazlur Rahman uses. And Fazlur Rahman is honest enough to admit that nobody before him has ever interpreted in this manner. I like that honesty. He simply says he doesn't understand it, he finds it strange, but he admits nobody before him has ever understood it in the manner that he wishes to take it. Now, I have read, as I said, over 30 tafsir with regards to these particular verses, and hopefully when the paper comes out in the footnotes we can talk more about specific names. There are three primary interpretations of this verse. A very few people said that the verse is abrogated. I found this more in Ibadi literature than Sunni literature, to be honest. The Sunnis, by and large, they didn't take this seriously, it's abrogated. The primary interpretation of this verse is that it occurs in the context of, once again, criticizing the people of the book. And this verse praises them. And there is a story that has already been mentioned yesterday of Salman al-Farisi coming to the Prophet and saying, how about my teachers? What's going to happen to them? So, the primary understanding of this verse has always been righteous Jews of their time, and righteous Christians of their time, and righteous Muslims of this time. All of them are under the general religion of Islam with a small I. And this is something that is a cornerstone of Muslim belief. There are other interpretations as well, but by and large, this is the primary understanding of this verse. The question of understanding this verse, the way that Fazlur Rahman and other modern reformers have done, simply never occurred to them. Far from finding the literal interpretation problematic, quite the contrary. They simply understood that any interpretation derived from this one verse had to be in accordance with the basic message and theme and hundreds of other verses in the Quran. To conclude, and the conclusion is a bit long, so. To conclude, this is of course an academic conference. And academics are supposed to present facts as if they're completely neutral observations without any agenda or inherent biases on the part of the presenter. But let us not fool ourselves. Even academics have their own biases, otherwise they wouldn't be human. And I believe that my own inclinations, as it were, are self-evident. And I do not pretend to make any claims otherwise. I am an academic. And I do wish to view things in as much of a neutral light as possible. But at the same time, I'm a Muslim, and not just a committed one, but rather one that has had extensive training in the classical sciences of Islam, and in particular the sciences of theology. Therefore, I cannot merely speak as an academic. I must also speak as a Muslim theologian, and it is from that perspective that I offer my concluding remarks. Being as unbiased as I believe is humanly possible, I do not think that a claim that the Quran itself promotes a vision of soteriological pluralism is a claim that can be supported, even with the most sophisticated hermeneutical gymnastics, or what Abdul Hakim Murad calls a Copernican revolution. The accusation that such a reading of the Quran is a presupposed reading, a cherry-picking of a selection of ambiguous verses which are then viewed with tinted lenses, is an accusation that is difficult to repudiate. No matter how politically correct, or theologically generous, or ethically pleasing such a reading is, in the end of the day, it is a reading that is simply not emanating from the Quran, but rather from external judgments of how things ought to be. They're emanating from a personal sense of unfairness, from individual experiences of acts of saintliness from the other. Such genuine and sincere feelings might well form the basis of one's personal convictions, but it would be unfair, unethical, and unacademic to extrapolate those sentiments and project them onto a religion that clearly has its own sources of theology and dogma. I think it is fair to say that the reason we have not seen the Quran historically read in this manner by anyone in the pre-modern era, even by the handful of Sufis who claim salvation outside of Islam, is simply because the Quran cannot be read in this manner with any sense of justice to the entire text. In fact, the assertion that some vacuous, undefined submission to God earns salvation flies in the very message of the life and times of the Prophet. Even the Quraysh, the arch enemies of the Prophet, submitted to God in some abstract sense. They believed in Him, they prayed to Him, they had some type of relationship with Him. To go even further, a pluralistic vision contradicts the very purpose of sending a prophet or revealing a book. It is as if a divine book is claiming to be God's final revelation, and a prophet is being told to announce his prophethood to all of mankind. But the message is, there's no need to believe in the message. A rather superfluous endeavor, to say the least. I do understand the awkwardness of my frankness, but if my youthfulness cannot be blamed for pointing out the emperor's nakedness, then I hope my theological conscience can. But my frank view does leave two very real problems, which exclusivists try to solve. The first of them concerns the human dimension, and the second, the divine. As for the human dimension, the main issue that is raised is the treatment of the other, like Rousseau himself referred to. How can I treat somebody nicely when I think that he is damned? It is true that an inclusivist view could potentially lead to prejudice and intolerance, but my point is it does not necessarily do so. In fact, quite the opposite can and does occur. And this is a tangible reality that those who are involved in the Muslim community can attest to. A Muslim might actually treat a non-Muslim better, even if it is done with the selfish motive of showing him the beauty of Islam and showing him how good Islam is. But a Muslim might treat a non-Muslim better, simply because he wants to show the validity of his own religion. Therefore, my point is, I do not view there to be an inherent relationship between bigotry and prejudice and between exclusivist or inclusivist theology. There could be, there couldn't be. We need to solve that through education. I believe the second problem is far more profound, and that is, does such a narrow view of salvation lead to an intolerant and unmerciful God? How could a just and merciful and loving God unconditionally assign his wrath to those who might have theological views other than our own, but nonetheless have much good in them? Our own Fareed Ishaq points out in his work on liberation theology, many of those who suffered fighting apartheid actually seem to exemplify Islamic values of standing for justice, of fighting on behalf of the poor and oppressed, more than many of the ultra-isolationist Muslim clerics. What is to be done of the clear examples of saintliness found in other religions? Or as one of the presenters said, does Saddam get to go to heaven and Mother Teresa go to hell? Well, to respond to this, the orthodox position would be that the religion requires not just orthopraxy, but also orthodoxy. The religion requires good belief and good actions. Iman and Amal al-Salih is the Quranic terminology, together. But I don't think that that's our only response. I think that even from the most ultra-orthodox, traditionalist understanding of Islam, we can provide some glimmer of hope for such people. Not a bright, shining, radiant light that some reformers would like to see, but at least a glimmer of hope. And that glimmer of hope can be argued historically from within the tradition. That glimmer of hope is based upon two basic principles. Number one, and that, well, this is my conclusion. Number one, I know you're looking at me with the... Number one, the Quran clearly conditions God's punishment on those who have received the prophetic message and understood it and then rejected it. There has to be a bayan and a takdeeb. There has to be a understanding and then a knowing and conscious rejection. Like Ibn Taymiyyah says, that whoever opposes the guidance after it has been made clear to him. Ibn Taymiyyah says there must be a tibyan, there must be a bayan, there must be an attempt to make the religion clear to him. What this also means is that those who have not been exposed to Islam or exposed to it in an improper manner might possibly have an excuse on the day of judgment. And only God can fully judge whether someone has been exposed to Islam in a proper and correct manner. I personally don't know if I meet John and Jenny in the street whether they've heard the real message of Islam or whether they watch Fox News, in which case they will be excused on the day of judgment. Secondly, at least with regards to the Sunni tradition, there is a very explicit theological premise of not assigning a judgment of heaven and hell to a particular individual, no matter how righteous or evil, how Muslim or kafir the person was, but rather of leaving the individual fate to God. A specific non-Muslim is never said to be in hell, and a specific Muslim is never said to be in heaven, because the basic premise is only God has the right to judge. As 13:40 says, إِنَّمَا عَلَيْكَ الْبَلَاغُ وَعَلَيْنَا الْحِسَابُ. Your job is to convey, our job is to judge. We speak in generalities. Those who are good and righteous shall enter heaven. Not Yasir or Ahmed will enter heaven. We speak in generalities and not in specifics. When a theologian affirms the supremacy of his own tradition, when I affirm the supremacy of my tradition, I am not saying that I'm going to go to heaven and you're going to go to hell. Not at all. Rather, what I am saying is that I am following a path that leads to God's mercy. And that path is perfect. But I am a human being, am imperfect. You are following a path that will not lead you to God's mercy, but you as a human being might have perfect qualities. You might have good in you, and God might possibly reward you for that good. The judgment is on the paths and not on the individuals. Therefore, putting all of this together, I believe that there is no need for a radical reconstruction of our faith. There is hope for good people outside of the fold of the faith, but that hope is an exception to the rule, and it is one that God, in His infinite wisdom and mercy, dispenses, and not one that His servants preach and make the general rule. For those who believe in an all-merciful and all-wise God, we leave it to Him to judge people, and we trust His judgment. So to answer the question of whether there are multiple paths to God or one path, I believe the Quran is explicitly clear on this issue. In chapter 6, verse 153, we are told to announce, "My Lord has guided me to a straight path, A righteous religion, the religion of Ibrahim, the Hanif. And this is my path, the straight path. So follow it and do not follow other paths, because they will lead you astray from his path. This is what he has commanded you, so that you may achieve righteousness. May God make us all amongst those who are righteous. And with that, I conclude my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yasir Qadhi. Now the time for question and answer, and the topic title was Path of Allah or Paths of Allah. So you need to keep that in mind. And as I requested you before, please make your question short and to the point so that many people can participate. And I will invite first the presenters to ask their questions and then open it to the public.
Let the inquisition begin.
Assalamu alaikum.
Loyola
Marymount University. Just a question of clarification. When you were talking about the Sufis, particularly Rumi, I thought I heard you say that Rumi didn't quote the Quran or Hadith, or were you saying that when he quotes the Quran and Hadith, he's not quoting these particular passages?
So, from my reading, and if you find verses or evidences, please correct me. I am by no means an expert in all of Rumi or Ibn Farid. From my reading of the passages that talk about pluralism and talk about soteriological exclusivity, I haven't found them quoting such verses that are quoted by the modern reformers. Now, if you do find some examples, please do bring them to me.
I mean, Bill's not here, Bill Chudik isn't here, but you know, the Sufi Path of Love is great, because I use that with my students, because he actually, one of the things I love about, and I can say this about Bill because he's not here, one of the things I love about his translations is he actually gives, you know, here's where Rumi is quoting from the Quran, here's where he's quoting from the Hadith, here's the kinds of, you know, the evidences there. So
I'll be interested in seeing that. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yes, please. Okay, please come in.
Farid, you can jump the queue.
Yeah. Hi. Farid is up.
Yes,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, thank you very much. Let me push you to elaborate further on the civil implications of this theology. You clearly reject Rousseau's notion that exclusivism leads to social intolerance. What are the practical implications? How exactly would you say that a Muslim who embraces the exclusivist theology that is so central to the intellectual tradition should go about relating to non-Muslims in daily life today?
That question is a question that we as American Muslims are grappling with, and we have a lot of extremes within our communities, and I am in my opinion, I'm very involved with the conservative Muslims, trying to make them rethink through these issues. I agree with you. I fully agree that such tendencies of viewing Islam as being very inclusive can lead to prejudice and intolerance. There is no doubt that those people, such as Al-Qaeda, are viewing the world from that type of mindset. There's no denying that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a causal linkage. It's a possibility. This belief has been mainstream Muslim beliefs for the last 14 centuries. Not all of them have been Al-Qaeda sympathizers or that type of mentality. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, this belief does have the potential to be misused and abused. I agree with that. But we can also revert it around. And like I said, many times, and I've heard this myself, and I'll tell you, for as being an activist within the Muslim community, Muslims actually use this to treat non-Muslims better. And I agree, it's a selfish motive. You want them to see how good Islam is. But far from civil disobedience, there's a double standard that if there's a non-Muslim, of course, the famous joke, if we have an appointment at 9 o'clock, if a Muslim gives the appointment, we'll show up at 9:30. But if it's non-Muslim, we'll show up at 8:55. There's this understanding that we have to make sure that we're to the dot. We dot the I's and cross the T's when it's with a non-Muslim. So simple education can clarify this point. I don't see this as being a necessary causal relationship.
Let me push you to be more specific. If an undergraduate at Yale comes to you and says, I'm a Muslim, I've heard what you've said, advise me, how should I relate to my non-Muslim classmates?
Well, the Quran is very clear in Surah Mumtahina, verse 8. God says, God is not preventing you from those who have not opposed you or made your life or religion difficult to practice. God doesn't stop you from showing them the utmost kindness. The word that is used, bir, is the same word that is used to show kindness to parents. God says, I'm not stopping you from treating them nicely. I am stopping you from treating those who have opposed you, those who have tried to kill you, those who have tried to prevent you from worshiping God. I have stopped you from taking them as protectors.
I want to say that, thank you very much for your presentation. I don't for a moment want to come across as condescending or patronizing, but I very genuinely, I thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. I delighted in your erudition, in your knowledge, in the vastness of your reading, in the very explicit way in which you articulated what you understood the tradition. Don't worry, there isn't a long but coming.
I was waiting for the but.
No, there isn't a long but coming. It's just kind of, what? Okay, next, say it. No, there isn't a long but. You do freeze the tradition. You do reify the tradition. Your slip showed very briefly in response to the question before me, where you said, we as American Muslims. Oh, so there is such a thing as an American Muslim. There is such a thing as Muslims living in a particular time and a particular context, grappling with particular things, and possibly having to find local responses, local answers to it. And yet, when you talk about Islam and the Islamic tradition, right in the beginning of your talk, you speak about purely theological response. I don't know, Yasser, if there is anything such as a purely theological response. When you talk about, and I'm not one of them, but when you talk about us as American Muslims, you are tearing at this idea of a reified Islam. When you look at the anthropology of Islam, the real world of Muslims, you don't see any centers. You only see enormous peripheries all over the place. And you now want to tell us that there is a particular center reflected through, say, Ibn Taymiyyah, or a particular, this tradition, 30 tafasir and so on. I put it to you that perhaps there are no centers. There are only all of these peripheries struggling with what it means to be Muslim and how to relate to the many, many others.
Thank you very much. First, Rasak, I have to say that I admire you immensely for your work, and I have read your work cover to cover, and I sense the passion, I sense the sincerity, and I stand before you today, obviously having done nothing compared to what you have done in apartheid South Africa, and obviously it really humbles me that we're actually standing on the same platform, and I want to say that quite clearly, that even if we have these trivial disagreements, I look up to you and admire you immensely for the efforts and work that you've done, and I understand why the book was written. You actually say quite clearly that you find people that are helping you out that are more Muslim, as you say, than many of the Muslims who refuse to help you out in your anti-apartheid campaign. So with that disclaimer, there's also a but, and that is that, yes, there are certain elements of Islam that will not change. I'm an American Muslim. I'm also Pakistani by heritage. I also like certain cuisines. My skin color is a certain way. My language is a certain way. That doesn't change the God that I worship. Certain things will be modified in America. Fiqh will be modified. Yes. How we interact, how we dress, what we, 100 years ago, many of our ulama would say, you can't even dress like this, as you know. Elements of fiqh will change from time to time and place to place. But the names and attributes of God are not going to change if I'm in America versus Timbuktu. The basic theology of our religion is not going to be different. And in my opinion, this understanding of our religion being the only path to God is one such basic theological premise, which should not change from time to time to place to place. Maybe even our treatment of the other can change. Yes, I'm even up for that. Yes, because that's not theology in the end of the day. But basic principles of theology, I think it's common sense, right? The nature of God, the names of God, the path to God, this should not change from time to place. So as we are in America and we're grappling with Islam, many issues will have to be rethought. Many issues will have to be, we're going to go back to the drawing board for that. I'm the first person, and many of you here are aware of what I'm doing in that regard. Despite my conservative stance in many issues, I am at the forefront in certain movements trying to carve the way forward. Nonetheless, theology is not up for grabs. Theology doesn't change from era to era and time to time and place to place. And this is an issue of theology. Whoever knows the Prophet and understands the message of the Prophet fully, and then chooses to disobey it, the Quran is quite clear. But again, we speak in generalities. We will never pronounce a verdict on a specific person. Never. God knows whether they knew or not. So I agree with you, and yet respectfully, I disagree when it comes to theology. Thank you.
Any other question? That would be the last one.
Thank you for the presentation. I have 2 points to make. One point is that can't you keep this kind of orthodoxy with something a little bit less than sending all the other ones to hell? Especially given the fact that the key phrase, I think, that you mentioned is that the other ones, before they get condemned, and of course we're not talking about individuals, it's just this action of rejecting Islam, it has to be with full understanding of the truth of Islam. Well, I mean, you can define full understanding of the truth of Islam that nobody in his right mind is going to reject that. I mean, if they reject it sincerely, then clearly they haven't understood the truth of Islam. Because if they understood it to be true, they wouldn't be rejecting it. If you do that, then you could say that, well, so then the vast majority of Christians and Jews and whatever, they can still be saved, even though they rejected Islam, because they didn't understand the full truth of Islam.
Well, I don't think we disagree, because again, I'm talking about paths and not individuals.
Yeah.
I think we agree on this point.
But then you could say that, well, then what about the path that this person is following, which is other than Islam, but it doesn't involve a rejection of the truth of Islam? Could another path that has elements of Islam in it not bring somebody closer to God?
Of course, other paths will bring them maybe closer to God, but they are not the correct path or the Sirat al-Mustaqim. That's the Quranic message. So it's not a black and white either or. There is one path that definitely leads to salvation. Other paths don't necessarily get to that level, but they might get to other levels. And God in His mercy might forgive people who have taken those other paths.
But all right, it could get to other levels. Could those other levels be considered levels of felicity? I mean, like if heaven has 8 different...
It's not a matter of assigning levels based upon paths. Those are assigned based upon individual faith and actions. Once again, we're talking about paths, and the religion of Islam claims to be the only path to God. Now, as I said, the exceptions exist. Those exceptions will remain exceptions, and God will grant them to however millions or billions of people He wants. But in terms of paths to God, I cannot find the Quran telling me that there are multiple paths to God. And I don't think this has been the standard and dominant position of all of the theological schools of Islam.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I have permission to take one more, so Professor Madigan, you are lucky one, and the last one.
Thank you, Yasser, for that presentation. I think you've convinced me in your analysis of these texts. The question that remains in my mind, though, is the circularity of authority. I mean, every religious tradition is in this position. If you say, as you do, the Quran says that the Quran is authoritative, and the prophet who is delivering the Quran says that you must believe in this prophet, there's no solid ground to base that on. It's an existential decision that one takes to read this text, which is making a claim for itself, to hear this prophet who is making a claim for himself, and to choose freely that taqlid, to put the qallad on this person. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that worries me about the whole thing. Why is it? I would have difficulty thinking of Jesus Christ as the authoritative Word of God, if the kind of message that that you're proposing for the Quran, if that were the message that I were hearing from him, I wouldn't think it authoritative. It comes down to a fundamental choice of what kind of message do you want to hear? What kind of message do you want to credit as being the divine message? It's not simply because anyone can come along and say, I am a prophet. You make a big point about the recognition of all prophets, but that doesn't mean the recognition of anyone who happens to say, I'm a prophet. The recognition of all prophets is a prior decision about who is a prophet and who you're going to recognize. So whilst I agree with, I think I'm convinced by your analysis of the texts, I'd want to bring it back to the question of why do you privilege this text? And what does the privileging of this text entail in terms of an existential decision?
That's a very profound question, and I wish I could answer it in 2 minutes properly, but the Quran calls people to accept in its message for many, many reasons. This particular issue of salvational exclusivity is not one of the selling points of Islam. It is a package deal. When you enter the religion, you just have to accept that as well. We're not going to advertise our faith through this particular theological doctrine. But we do advertise our faith primarily through the concept of God and monotheism, primarily through the names and attributes of God. We do advertise our faith based upon issues of morality, based upon issues of ethics. We do advertise our faith based upon the key principles of belief in God, the prophets, the angels, the day of judgment. The Quran many times claims people to think about this text, to think about the life of the prophet, to think about God himself. So this is what, if you like, are the selling points, right? The Quran never ever says accept Islam because of this salvational path. It's not going to be a selling point. So I agree with you there. Why do I personally believe in this message? I think, Farid Asaq, I'm going to quote you exactly on this yesterday, what you said. When you hear the Quran being recited, you just know that this is the Word of God. In the end of the day, I have my doubts, yes. No matter, I'm a theologian, so my students are going to be shocked when I say, of course, you all have doubts. We all have doubts. We're all human, right? There are things that I don't understand. I'll be the first to say that. But when I recite this book, and when I listen to this book being recited, I have no doubt whatsoever that this is the final revelation. It moves me in a way that nothing that is created, it is uncreated for me. It moves me in a way that nothing that is created could move me. So that is my reason.
Sorry, we are out of time.
Oh, come on.
but the sponsor honors his teacher.
It's not a very profound question. Don't get your hopes up.
So in respect of organizer's teacher, please go ahead.
I did though, Yasser, as with everyone else, I appreciate the circumspect manner and the explicitness with which you presented your presentation. I wanted to follow up though on a comment that you made in response to Farid with regard to theology not being up for grabs and that theology does not change. Are you not in that context sort of flattening theology out to a battery of considerations that are all of the exact same levels of priority? I mean, clearly there are primary, secondary, and tertiary aspects of theology, and yes. Theology, even among traditionalists, I mean, Ibn Taymiyyah is not the same as Ibn Hanbal, when it comes to theology. So the whole idea of theology even developing in America, that is a possibility that you would acknowledge.
You're obviously very correct, and as a profound example as well that I'm very familiar with. Of course, understandings of the religion do develop, but key tenets don't change over time. Our God is Allah. It's not going to become Baal tomorrow, right? We believe in a God that is transcendent. We're not going to worship an idol in another country. So certain elements will remain immutable. Others, yes, they will be developed. I wouldn't say they would change necessarily, but I would say that we wouldn't be aware of them. We wouldn't think through them. Issues of predestination. The companions didn't think through them the way that our major Sunni theologians did.